all three of the groups that I've discussed that they would welcome a framework, you know, similar to the Te Ahu Aturanga framework, so, which I think is probably, as I say, I don't want to just, it wouldn't be appropriate to adopt wholesale a framework that's been used for quite a different project, but I think we're all reasonably aligned that that provides a strong starting point.
That's actually really helpful, getting that clarification from you, though, in terms of what you envisage the Mana Whenua Engagement Framework to look like. Because I was going to try and get some clarification around the degree to which it might resemble, without some of those other, you know, aspects to it, the design framework that was adopted by the Te Ahu Aturanga roading approach. So that is sort of the basis, is it, for the development of a Mana Whenua framework, engagement framework.
Yes, I believe so. In as much as obviously we haven't seen those detailed documents because they're confidential to Wakakatahi and iwi, but as that project has been described to me in terms of representation at project governance groups, involvement in design panels, involvement in the development of management plans, some of those things. And then, as I say, possibly some wider specific aspects to do with the ongoing operation of the hub.
That's really helpful. Thank you. And just in my mind to get some clarity around the distinction between the what's being proposed as a Mana Whenua engagement framework and the working framework agreement that's been mooted in terms of establishing a partnership approach between iwi and Kiwi Rail to the development of the freight hub site. Are you able to provide me with some clarification around that distinction?
I'm not sure there is one.
Okay. So it might just be a slightly different terminology that's being used for the same thing.
I think
I'm referring here, perhaps I should take you to the paragraph. It's in 6.8 of your evidence. And there you talk about the proposed NOR Mana Whenua engagement framework. So in addition to that, Kiwi Rail and iwi are working towards developing a working framework agreement. And the iwi engagement will continue throughout the development of the freight hub. So this is more about working towards developing effective and productive iwi relationships, as I understand it.
I think that's right. I think if I was going to characterise a difference, I would say that there is a proposed condition around the establishment of a framework.
Yes.
But when we talk about working framework agreement, that is probably an extension of what the condition establishes as a baseline. If I was going to draw a distinction, I think that would be what it was.
Okay, so it's a different aspect of... So it's a different aspect in terms of, you know, a more strongly focused commitment towards developing partnership relationships with iwi that comes out of that underlying Mana Whenua engagement framework. Would that be an accurate characterisation?
I think it's an extension. So what I'd say is the engagement framework in the NOR is about the engagement specific to the development of the project that is being consented, whereas there is a broader relationship in terms of, as I say, you know, our continuing role as neighbours, our continuing presence in the community and on land to which they are mana whenua, which is broader than that and would be wider than the specific framework around the development of the consented project. Mm. But I think... in practice, they will overlap and be very deeply intertwined.
Yes. Thank you. Then just moving to paragraph 7.7 of your evidence, where you there talk about the requests made by all of the iwi actually for a panel to be created, which they could be part of, in relation to... decision-making for the freight hub, and particularly in relation to natural resources within the Aroha.
Yes.
Now, how is it that KiwiRail intend to approach that particular request?
I think, again, that would be through the framework.
Through the framework.
Yep.
Okay, so there's scope within the framework, you think, for an accommodation to be made for this type of panel, if you
yes.
like. Was there something similar in the, I'm just trying to think whether the Te Ahu Aturanga design framework included something similar. I don't think it did.
I believe that, and probably actually the best person in the room to comment on this is Mr. Emery, who was involved. I believe that as part of the Te Ahu Aturanga framework, there was iwi engagement on design panels and involvement in management
yes.
plans and at a governance level, but there was also a resourced iwi engagement group that advised the project.
Okay. Thank you. Just checking my questions. I think we may have covered them all. Just in relation to the cultural values assessments.
Yes.
And I think you addressed this at paragraph 7.11. And I understand from what you've said that KiwiRail is intending to continue to work with the iwi to ensure they're appropriately resourced
yes.
to provide this kind of input through a cultural values assessment. Is that right?
Certainly we're committed to ensuring that they are resourced to provide the input. Whether that would necessarily take the form of a formal
yes.
cultural values assessment is probably something you need to work through, and which may also be up to iwi as to how
sure.
they would like to provide that input.
Yes, but from KiwiRail's point of view, if iwi so choose to provide their input and cultural effects assessment via a cultural values type report, then that would be acceptable.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's great. And if it is the wish and desire of iwi to provide their input that way, will they have the ability and opportunity to be resourced individually, or will there be a preference or a requirement from KiwiRail's point of view to provide a combined cultural values assessment?
I don't think that's our decision to make. I think they would be resourced to do it in the way that they felt was appropriate.
Thank you. I think that covers all of my questions.
Thank you,
thank you very much for your responses. It's most helpful. Most helpful.
Good afternoon, Ms. Paulson. Hopefully my questions will be relatively quick. In section 6.18 through to about 6.25, you talk about engagement with the wider community, and you set out the actions that KiwiRail has gone through from letter drops, offering one-on-one meetings with affected landowners, Zoom sessions, community drop-in sessions. Through to about September 2020, there seems to be quite a lot of activity. And from there, there seems to be a more of a reliance on the community coming to you. Could you expand on that a little bit more for me, what your ethos is in terms of your community engagement?
From recollection, that those sessions in terms of the community drop-in and the Zoom sessions, that sort of thing, led up to the submission of the notice of requirement. And from there, there's been emails, but I guess the notice of requirement has been submitted, and the focus then is turned to enabling the opportunity for public submissions and then thinking about how we respond to those as then being the ongoing forum, other than, as we say, you know, we talk about the community liaison forum to continue to capture that feedback.
So through the email address and the social pinpoint website, have you had any affected parties wanting to engage with you one-on-one following on from the original sessions that you had? Has there been any call for more community liaison, more active community liaison from them?
I don't monitor the email address, so I'd have to check with the wider team. I'm aware of one or two emails which I've responded to or assisted in responding to directly from specific members of the community seeking to engage on specific aspects of the proposal.
If you could check and get back to me, that would be helpful. Thank you. The other question I have is around the suggestion from council that there should be a NEIZ user group. So this is referred to in point 7.16 of your evidence. And you discuss the other stakeholders that you're engaged with around the area. So that you're involved with the reference group and steering group for the Central New Zealand Distribution Hub strategy and the, obviously the Palmerston North Integrated Transport Investment Project. Can you expand on why you believe that having a user group set up with your potential neighbours in the North East Industrial Zone is not appropriate?
Yes, so I think in terms of, and this was probably touched on a bit in Todd's evidence, there's a range of ways which people interact with the HUD. I think we have looked at, and we would see the boundaries of our project in as ensuring that there is efficient access to the HUD, and then working with those people as we would other neighbours across our sites and other potential customers. But we don't see as appropriate for a condition that mandates and deals with land use well outside our designation as being within the scope of what we should be controlling through this designation. That said, we are involved in broader engagement and ongoing engagement with those groups through things like the users group, which you referenced.
Okay, thank you.
For my questions, you will need your statement of evidence and the application or notice of requirement. So my questions are focused on Section 4, Master Plan, paragraphs 4.1 to 4.4, if you could just refresh your memory.
Mm-hmm.
And Clause 7 of the Notice of Requirement. So you emphasise in those paragraphs the central feature of this proposal, this project, is the ability to co-locate activities to achieve what you call an intermodal design.
Yes.
And that was part of what you describe as the master planning exercise by KiwiRail undertaken in 2019, correct?
The master planning exercise was about designing the most efficient layout for an intermodal hub, which
yeah.
could be seen.
And at paragraph 4.3, you talk about obtaining assistance from a North American branch of Stantec in terms of that master planning exercise.
Yes.
Was that input because they have particular expertise in master planning, or because they have particular experience about the intermodal character of railway operations that was evident in North America? In other words, was North America emblematic of that type of shift?
No, I don't
North American
that.
Experience.
I don't believe that was the case. I'm casting my mind back a long while, but I don't think it was about specifically North America, but it was about, fundamentally, we went out to seek an advisor to help us on this project who could work through with us master planning and concept design, multiple criteria analysis, and consenting. Rail expertise within Stantec, who was the selected provider, sat in North America.
Right, I got you. Because I'm sort of interested whether this trend that Mr. Moore talked about is actually an experience internationally in terms of how rail works with other types of transport.
I think that might be one you have to add to the list of questions for Mr. Skelton.
Oh, okay, we'll wait for him. But in terms of the notice of requirement, if you look at the second bullet point in paragraph 7, it seems very much that the idea of this intermodal concept is intrinsic to the nature and justification of this designation. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And so if those sorts of freight forwarding functions cannot be performed, then would that or would that not reasonably achieve your objectives?
I think without that ability to perform that freight forwarding activity on site, it would not be a genuinely intermodal hub. It would not achieve that objective.
Yeah. So that is actually fundamental to the whole DNA of the project in a way.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'll come back to Mr. Skelton about parts of it. Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been very helpful. Thank you. So, Ms. Arthur Young, did you have a desire to call the archaeologist today, or did you want a break?
That's quite a leading question, sir. Look, I'm a big fan of trying to get through the list, and I'm that's just my Canadian efficiency at play. But I'm also conscious it's been quite a long day. But Daniel is here, and I mean, in your hands, sir. He's here tomorrow as well. I don't think it's a shaking heads.
I think we do want to get through him, and then we can release him,
right,
if you don't mind. No disrespect.
Daniel, with that introduction, my goodness. Hopefully this means I have no questions for you. Okay. Right. So this is the soon-to-be-released archaeologist. Daniel Parker, sir, Director of Insight Archaeology Limited.
Welcome.
Thank you very much for your time. I'll keep this brief for everyone's sake. So,
good reading the room.
The freight hub is situated in a landscape that has been occupied for many centuries. Although for most of this time, the site was predominantly covered in a dense and relatively impenetrable forest. There are no registered historic places, recorded archaeological sites or listed heritage sites in the relevant district plans in the designation extent. There are no verified archaeological sites of Māori origin within the designation extent, and the pre-1864 archaeological potential is likely to be greatest alongside or in close proximity to the various streams and waterways. Provided any discoveries are properly documented, I consider that the adverse effects on these areas in terms of archaeological matters will be no more than minor. There are 74 historic sections owned by 25 resident individuals or families within the designation extent. All but one of these sections outlined below are assigned a uniformly and conservatively low site potential. Within the designation extent, three sites have been verified in my assessment as archaeological sites under the definition of the HNZ PTA. Because they have a confirmed location and extent and are confirmed to be pre-1900. These sites are the Rogers House at 489 Railway Road, the Cleverly House site at 121 Cleverly Line, and Bunnythorpe Suburban Section 1510 at 121 Cleverly Line, the Cleverly Historic Section. Another seven sites have moderate site potential, which have a confirmed location and extent and have a high probability of being pre-1900. And further research through the archaeological authority process is expected to result in the elimination of at least some of these from the list of affected archaeological sites. Adverse effects to potential post-1864 archaeological sites within the designation extent are generally expected to be in the negligible to low range. Of the nine houses, house sites, and buildings identified within the designation extent, only one is expected to be significantly adversely affected, this being the possible destruction of a standing building that may be Robert Volkirk's house, site number 14. Five moderately affected and three affected to no more than a low level. Site number 64, or Bunnythorpe Suburban Section 1510, is the one historic section site expected to be significantly affected due to the presence of sensitive sites. This section was purchased by Edwin Cleverly, one of the founding settlers at Bunnythorpe, and the family's homestead, site number 24, the Cleverly House site, which is also a verified site under the HNZ PTA definition, once stood on this property. The analysis of the Crown Grant plans and local electoral rolls indicates that other archaeological house sites are likely to be discovered inside the designation extent, but the number of additional sites is expected to be relatively small. Adverse effects to 19th century roads will be negligible. None of the affected roads will be removed completely, and important local names will be retained. There is also the potential for archaeological sites associated with railway construction to be encountered alongside the North Island Main Trunk, which was established in the 19th century. 23 potential pre-1900 houses and the Glaxo Laboratories building are located within 500 metres of the designation extent and may be subjected to indirect light or noise effects. It is anticipated that the proposed noise mitigation and lighting design within the designation extent will result in negligible effects to sites outside the designation extent. Overall, relative to the total land area of the designation extent, effects on archaeological sites and built heritage are limited and readily manageable under the provisions of the HNZ PTA. An archaeological authority or authorities to damage, modify or destroy archaeological sites will be required as a part of the management process. Due to the complexity of the freight hub and likely extent of effects to archaeological sites, HNZPT will require a research strategy and archaeological management plan to be prepared in addition to the standard documentation that must accompany any future authority application. Accidental discovery protocols are not required if an archaeological authority is already in place, but should be implemented for enabling works or construction activities that could affect unknown archaeological sites prior to an authority being granted. I agree with the recommendations in the Section 42A report that the accidental discovery protocol be prepared in consultation with Heritage New Zealand Pauheri Tonga, and that the accidental discovery protocol be modified to include details of contractor training, general procedure following accidental discovery, and custody of Tonga. These have been incorporated into the proposed conditions attached to Ms. Bell's evidence. I therefore understand that there are no outstanding issues in relation to the Section 42A report. Some submitters have raised some issues in relation to archaeological matters, which I have responded to in my evidence. No expert evidence has been provided on those matters, and I do not intend to repeat my response to those matters here. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Parker.
Kia ora, Mr. Parker. Thank you very much for your evidence. I found reading your evidence a breath of fresh air, I have to say, in the context of all the heavy technical evidence around stormwater and noise and vibration and things like that, although it's no less important, admittedly. But it was very interesting to read about the historical context in which the freight hub is going to be established if the NOR is approved, of course. My interest in your evidence is particularly around the Māori heritage sites, and I note from your evidence that there are no verified archaeological sites of Māori origin within the designation extent. But you do say that there is potential for the discovery of Māori heritage sites during the earthworks and construction process, and particularly around the streams and waterways, as these were areas that were traditionally used as nohoanga for hunting and gathering resources within what would have been a predominantly forested area. And so, given that the streams and waterways that traverse the site will be predominantly culverted and reclaimed as part of the development of the site, and therefore the potential for unearthing and discovering these Māori heritage sites, which you say in your evidence are actually rare finds. I just wonder whether, in your view, a more thorough archaeological investigation might be warranted prior to any construction taking place on site.
Well, that would certainly be required as part of the HNZ PTA process. So this would be looked at as the starting point for an archaeological investigation, and in order to provide the evidence to Heritage New Zealand for them to sign off on authority, I would expect that they would be looking for more detailed information and investigation. And there's a range of different methods and other documentary sources that I would want to check to go into that level of detail.
I see. So would that, greater level of, would that more thorough archaeological investigation not just apply to the sites that have been verified as existing within the designation, but would that also apply to the entire area?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so we're not just then reliant upon the accidental discovery protocol kicking in should something, be discovered and be recognised as being of archaeological significance.
Yes, absolutely. It would be okay. Going into particularly one of the areas would be to look into historic rates and roll valuation books.
Yes.
That's something that's not particularly easy accessible at the moment. They're only literally, you have to go to the archives and there's a whole lot of other precursor research that would need to take place first before that would actually be useful to go through that. And then going through those types of sources, that's where I would then be looking to see more information to work out the exact number of historic houses, because they should, in theory, appear in the rates and roll valuation books.
Yes, so that would certainly apply to the houses, but when we're talking about the potential for unearthing Māori heritage sites, that are going to be quite difficult, presumably, to recognise on the ground, particularly by a contractor who might be engaged to undertake the earthworks. What you're saying is that the investigations that would be undertaken prior to any construction taking place would be thorough enough to be able to pick up and identify sites of that nature.
Yes, and it would be also having further discussion with our iwi partners about are there areas that we need to look into a bit more closely to do some further investigative work in detail into those areas as well.
That's very helpful. Thank you for that. And just one further question, just to ease my mind. I note from your evidence, as you said yourself, that that your report hasn't assessed Māori cultural values, which you you say would be you know, better left to iwi to provide that assessment. But I'm just, while I accept that and I understand the rationale for that view, I'm just wondering whether that makes your archaeological assessment in any way less complete, or does it make your conclusions, for instance, any less reliable, given that the Māori cultural values assessment hasn't been integrated into your archaeological report?
So I have acknowledged that as one of the limitations in my assessment. It is my general practice to consult quite closely with iwi in most of my projects, but in most of the projects that I'm involved in, unfortunately, archaeology is a bit of a last-minute thought, and so people have made their decisions, the developers done whatever they want, and we need to deal with archaeology, call the guy in, just go and deal with him. Here I've been brought in at a very early stage, and I'm part of a wider team, and so although I have working relationships with Rangatane Manawatū, Ngāti Kaupata, Ngāti Raukawa Ki Te Tonga, it's not appropriate for me at this stage to jump ahead of that process, and so we would need to engage and deal with some of those issues and recognise some of those values as part of the HNZ process. And that goes into the way that they factor in their decisions about, is it appropriate for this site to be damaged, modified or destroyed?
Yes.
So that's definitely something that would have to come in that later process.
Thank you very much. Be most helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Parker. Just a quick question for me, of one of clarification really. In 7.11 of your summary,
yes,
you say that 8 houses, house sites and buildings will be affected to a low or moderate degree. What do you mean by that?
So the degree of effect, it depends on a number of things. It depends a little bit on the likelihood that it is an archaeological site. And then the question is, well, if it's an archaeological site, what's the level of value? So if we were to, if the freight hub was to result in the destruction of a nationally significant site, you're starting at the top end. You know, if there was evidence for an urupā or something like that, that would be a significant effect. If we were coming down to the point of a shell midden or a 19th century well, these are incredibly common. They're found everywhere. And so we would say that the values for that are less. And by removing that one site from the archaeological landscape, the effect is a lot lower. At the moment, we had the one house which is recognised as being potentially significant. And that's because we're uncertain, but it's possibly connected with one of the very earliest settlers for Bunnythorpe. These other houses, stylistically, they appear that they could be 19th century. They could also be early 20th century. But there's no evidence to connect those houses for most of them, there is no evidence to connect them to the early settlers, the particularly significant local personalities. There are two houses that are one standing house that is connected to an important local early settler family, and that's the Rogers House. And if that house had been in pristine condition or was still occupied and livable, I would consider that to be a potentially significant effect. But unfortunately, that house suffered some damage by fire. And so on the basis of that, I would say that the starting point is lower. And so the effect of potentially taking a site like that out of the landscape is lower than if it was, say, still occupiable and being used as a house.
That's really helpful, just to understand what you meant by that in the context of it's not a house per se that might be adversely affected to a low or moderate degree, as we've put it in RMA terms necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's more so the relating then to the value of that house or that site,
yeah,
in terms of its archaeological values. That's very helpful to understand that distinction. Thank you.
There are no other questions, so you are released.
Thank you.
Ms. Oliver, is this room locked in the evening? Yeah, so those of you who are brave enough to leave materials here, it will be locked. We will resume at 9 a.m. and hopefully your economist will be well enough to present tomorrow.
Yes, sir. We've just confirmed him on the phone. I'm coming out tonight.
Yeah. All right. So we'll adjourn and resume tomorrow. Thank you very much.